Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is a bit more of a landmark episode for us here. So we're actually up to episode 50. Now, apart from 50 being this episode, it's a Jubilee episode, of course, we could call it that. 50 is the atomic number of tin. Did you know that the Earth is roughly 50 times the volume of the Moon? There are also 50 states in America. Funnily enough, I've been to 25 of them. In the past. And in base 5, 50 is written as 200. Now, also, there are 50 ways to draw a square using the points of a 4x4 grid. If anyone wants to try that, send your efforts in. So we're on episode 50. And, yeah, so what are we going to do on this episode? Because it's going to be a little bit different this time, isn't it?
I thought we'd just do a bit of just getting the what we've been up to out of the way. And I thought we'd go through our list of computers, or how we got into computers, really, what we listed with computers, etc., to where we are today, really. So, I've got a couple of things to say at the start. Actually quite amazed we actually got to episode 50. I didn't think we'd get this far. So... I've got a couple of things to say. Word from Gushoff, he's the main technical guy at Veeam. You probably heard me talk about him before, or about the Veeam software to back up virtual machines and VMware. Every week he releases an email. Well, it's kind of, you sign up for their forum where you can go online and talk to, just if you've got any problems or anything. And they... every week you get an email from the forum, and it basically got this from him, so it's quite a useful thing. And he was just talking about, if you get crypto locker, how do you find the PC which is kind of got the locker, the software on it, which is basically encrypting all your files. So it just said what it said. As I say, usually, if it's dead simple, just open properly the decrypted instruction file that gets created by the ransomware and see who the file owner is. This will usually point to the infected user machine. If this does not help because the owners in a group or ransomware are super smart, go to computer management, snap in on the file server with the files being encrypted, and open shared open files. And one of the users will have hundreds of open files. This will be in it. Now, just disable that user and the computer accounts until the issue is resolved. The problem, this performs the latest Veeam backup. I mean, you can restore your Veeam backup. So, yeah, just saying that about how you can find out who's encrypting files on your network, really. So this is interesting. And then the other thing is about add to upgrader ESXi from version 5.5 to version 6. So what you can normally do is, so I know that people are like, you can erase it and then install it again from scratch, but then you have to basically put the settings and everything. But what you can do is you can get a support bundle from VMware, and you can basically upload that to the data store, and then you can run a ESXi command to actually upgrade it. It doesn't take that long at all. So you basically take all the VMs off that host, put it into maintenance mode, and then you run this command, and it then upgrades it, reboots, and then you've got version 6 on it. So I'll put a link in the show notes to that. And also, I had a funny one as well. You know, I was talking the other day about... that I got a computer, Windows 10 computer from my father-in-law. He had an issue where the battery died on it. And, well, it just died and it lost. And ever since he booted on it, it wouldn't connect to the Wi-Fi. It connected to the Wi-Fi fine, but it had limited connectivity. So, no, it was connected, but it wouldn't get your DHCP address. So, I tried uninstalling the driver, reinstalling the driver, disconnected from the Wi-Fi, reconnected, nothing kind of worked. I'll put links in the show notes, but you can run it. I'll probably talk about this, the net sh command. So you do two net sh commands, which is net SSH WinStick WinSock Reset Catalog, and then NetSH INT IP4 Reset, and click Return, and that will basically just reset the IP stack in Windows 10. And when it came back up again, when you reboot the PC, you have to reconnect to the Wi-Fi, but it wouldn't say not limited connectivity. It just said that it had internet access, and it had internet access again. So, just in case anyone comes across that one in the future, one to keep in the back of the bag, really. So, what have you been up to, you two guys?
I haven't really done that much of interest that's good for this show. I've had plenty of little bits that have been on. They've all been run-of-the-mill kind of stuff, so there's not really too much to bring. But funnily enough, I did come across a ransomware this week. Now, I've got to find out actually what happened in the end with it, really, because we found out there's only two computers. It's like a daycare nursery type of thing. And there's only two computers in the office there. So one of them had got infected. I didn't know it got infected until it got there. And I had the message up on the screen, you know, your stuff has been encrypted, blah, blah, blah. I can't remember which one it was exactly. So we basically went through the options. Now, the person who actual computer usually used it was not there at the time. So this is the bit I've got to kind of catch up with them on, because the other person there seemed to think that they've... Right, you actually may know the answer to this if you've had experience with it. They've been using OneDrive because they've got Office 365. Now, the files on the PC were encrypted, but we couldn't find out whether the files on OneDrive, you know, because they synchronize up, or whether OneDrive kind of filter them out and block them. So that's the bit I don't know, because he said if they can get the stuff off OneDrive without it being infected, then that's fine. That's not a problem for them. Because the other person who wasn't there was last known to access it remotely from their house on the OneDrive account. So the other bit that I don't know as well is if the computer in the office got infected, did it go up to OneDrive, and then did it go down to the the person working at home on the remote laptop or not? I haven't spoke to her yet, so I'm not sure. If it is all infected, then they've got a bit of a problem. It's all the account spreadsheets and who's paid them and who hasn't and stuff like that. It's not as if they've lost all the information, because they could redo it, you know, manually, go through paperwork, go through bank statements and put it all back in again. But obviously that's a big, big, big job. So do you know, or any of you know, whether OneDrive will filter any encrypted files out like that?
I don't think they will.
Or whether it'll let it through. I thought it'd be very... I didn't think they will. I thought the chance would be like that. What?
Do they do file versioning on OneDrive? I'm pretty sure they do on Dropbox. So if you've got versioning, then you can go back to an unencrypted version.
Okay.
That's the whole defence against ransomware is have off-site backups, you know, version backups.
Yeah.
Because even if you've got automated backups, you could still be backing up the encrypted stuff.
That's right, yeah.
So,
but this is back to where, you know, synchronization and backup are not the same thing, you know, in its entirety. And also as well, it renamed the file extension to .zzzzzzz. That's what it had renamed it to. So if they do the file versioning, then the previous version will be .docx or .xlss, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So a couple of things you want. If you go, so obviously if it changes, it will then sync up to the cloud. So you could go, you can access OneDrive through a web browser. So you could go to web browser and then go into the web browser portal of it and then see if it's in there.
Yeah.
And then what you can do is, when you're in there, you can right click the file and go to version history. And because basically OneDrive is SharePoint, but for every drive, yep, for your files. So you can then go, obviously you want to restore everything, you basically go to one file and go restore history, restore this one. So it's going to be quite a lot. But according to this, I'll put a link in the show notes to this, but there's how to deal with ransomware at Office 365. If you've got a large number of files are impacted, it says user interface to the portal will not be a viable option. In this case, create a support request for a site collection restore. This restore can take up to 14 days in the past. This restore can restore up to 14 days in the past. So, yeah. So it could take a long time to get it. But I'll put a link in the show notes for that. So that's why really OneDrive isn't really a backup solution for
that. They weren't actually using it as a backup. They didn't have any backup. I suppose they were using it as a backup in that respect. But the reason, the person in question has gone off on maternity leave. So she went off prior to, while still being pregnant, and is still off now because now she's not pregnant. So this is why I haven't spoke to the person.
Yeah.
But that was one of the reasons, because she obviously owns the business, you see. So she wanted to access various files and their emails and stuff like that, you know, while she was at home. So that was one of the reasons, actually, why the Office 365 was set up in the first place. So she could have all the stuff on there, you know, and it could be accessed from office or home and things like that. So okay, well, I'll report back on another show about that, see what happens. But that's the only kind of relatively interesting thing I've done this week. It's all been cleaning this out and, you know, something else that somebody else, a broken power socket, you know. It's all, you know, not too networky or anything like that. So that's me for now anyway.
Yeah, so I've had a couple of things. I do backup service for my clients, some of my clients, which uses R Snapshot. So it basically does a process on my server that goes into their servers via SSH and copies the data over. And the way R Snapshot works, it only copies the data that's changed over. Theoretically, that gives you version, as we were saying, version backups, incremental. And the only extra space you need is for changes that have happened since the last backup. So problem is, one of my clients seems to be adding 27 gigs every time I do a backup. So the smallest time increment is 4 hours. So 27 gigs every 4 hours bumps up the disk space usage quite a bit. I think I've got 2 terabyte volume that it's going to, but that's also shared with other clients. So
when I'm doing video editing, I don't do 28 gigs in 2 hours.
Yeah, it's a strange one. I think it's there's some process just adding random files. It's not filling up his disk too quickly, but it's when it's on an incremental basis like that, I think mine's back up to 93% usage, so I've got to do something about that. I'll probably work that out on the train tomorrow or something. But finding that, possibly deleting the file from older backups to make a bit of space. Yeah, this space management, not the most interesting thing, but it just sort of came up. I was just looking at my server. Probably should have set up alerting on it and monitoring to monitor for that kind of thing. But I'm aware of it now, so I'll fix it. Yeah, I had a funny one. Not a regular client, but he got in touch with me because he had a machine on Linode, which was kept restarting for no apparent reason. So nothing in the log files that I could see when I went in, which is the main sort of forensic thing you look at, I suppose, on a Linux box. Go to the logs, see if there's anything there that's telling you why it's resetting or why it's suddenly dropping out. Doesn't seem to be. So the fact it's a virtual machine, I put it down to the fact that the physical host was bad. So the physical host that the virtual machine is sitting on is bad, because once a VM is fired up, it typically won't move from the physical machine that it's on.
Yeah.
So I have advised him, but basically cloned that node, which would almost certainly have put it onto a new bit of hardware. So now that's done. It's just a case of waiting and seeing if it goes down again. Might be worth mentioning the software as a service that I use to monitor that. It's called Status Cake. I'll put a link in the show notes.
What does that do?
It basically pings a URL for you. People might have heard of Pingdom, but that costs quite a lot of money to run.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is a free tier anymore. I think there might have been in the past. But so one that I just found or was recommended or something was called Statuscake, and it seems to do the job really well. Just pings you an email when your site goes down. It lets you put as many. I don't think there's a limit to the amount of sites you can monitor. It's got a free tier which constantly nags you to upgrade, but apart from that, it does the job pretty well. So Statuscake. The only other thing I wanted to mention was being at my new day job, which I mentioned in an earlier episode. I came across an instance of something not working, not being particularly familiar with the environment. So I've been there 3 months, but they have quite complex environments. And an app was failing, as in a web app was failing. The knock-on effect that it had was quite instructive, because it just shows that when someone comes to you with an issue, it might not be your fault. That's what I took from it. So this app basically used SFTP to grab something from another source, so which is another company. So another company runs an SFTP server. Our server grabs a file from it. And then another bit of software running on our infrastructure does something else with it and processes it. So what was happening was the SFTP was failing, not failing to log in or anything, but failing to CD to a directory, probably because the box on the other end didn't have the directory mounted or something.
Okay.
And that was causing the process to just crash out, and didn't have proper error handling or anything to inform anyone, no monitoring on it. So that's kind of historical reasons. Monitoring could and probably should be failed. But I didn't think it was a particularly well-designed way of getting this data from one place to another. Too many links in the chain. If any link goes wrong, then the whole thing fails.
Yeah.
And there's no monitoring to tell you it's failed. So it's just an angry client saying, why isn't this happening? And then you have to spend half a day doing detective work to find out what it was.
Yeah, trying to work out where it is. Why isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was kind of... It's quite a good bit of detective work, but it was one of those things where I could have saved, we could have saved half a day, done something useful instead. So, yeah, that's my lot, really.
Okay. I was going to say, so I'm going to go through what computers we had, kind of thing. That would be quite a good thing to do. So where's my list gone? So the first computer I really had, I think I must have been like 6 or 7 or something. And it went around my cousin's house. They had an Acorn Electron, which I think is like a home version of the BBC Micro. I think it was the same thing as the BBC Micro, but it didn't have mobile pluggable options. It and that was like on a had a like a really big tape drive. It wasn't like one of those little tape drives you get. Like one of those like a big stereo they had connected to it to load the games into it. I remember playing on their Frogger, and was it Elite? The one with the screen with the where you go like
vector graphics.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was I think that was first on the BBC Micro, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember. Yes, that's like kind of the first had. And I remember at school we had a BBC Micro, like our primary school. It had the logo, that logo with the turtle, so you could like go forward 40, left or left 90 degrees or whatever, and you could make it like it draw a square or whatever, it would go. Mm.
Yeah. And you could, if you repeat, like if you go forward and then turn 90 degrees and then go, and then repeat that four times, so you get a square.
Yeah, so, was it called Logo or something, I think?
Logo, yeah. Yeah, Logo was awesome.
Yeah. So the first computer we had at home was my CPC, was an Amstrad CPC 6128 with a colour screen and a 3-inch floppy drive. So not the 3.5, it had its own 3-inch drive, which was a bit odd. Loads of games I remember playing on that when I got that for Christmas that first year. Like I think it was Druid or something I remember playing. But you could never save anything, could you, in those old days? You could never save a game, could you?
Mm. Games had, you had 3 lives, so
yeah.
And I saw,
yeah, and you start again.
Yeah.
I remember from there I got a printer at some point as well for that. Like, you had to have a bit on the back which went onto that, like a massive RDE cable to like a massive dot matrix printer. And then at middle school we had an Acorn Archimedes, was that a thing?
Oh yeah. That was RISC PC, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, the next one was called RISC PC, but and it had this different CPU architecture, didn't it?
Yeah. And that's the first time I ever saw a mouse, or got to use a mouse kind of thing. So, they went to high school. We got an Apple Mac Plus, which is so they didn't have PCs at my, they had Apple Macs. It was like an Apple Mac Plus, and it had an external hard drive on the side of it. Like, I had a box next to it which had the hard drive in it. Remember always getting up early to go to school to play on them, kind of thing. Just playing games or doing something. And then they were networked to a printer. And then this is like before the days of the internet, kind of thing. So yeah, and then we had to remember going to that they got an Apple a Macintosh LC, which had external CD-ROM drive in it, and it had like. It was in the library, so you could basically put the CDs in it, but the CDs came in a cartridge, which was really odd. I don't know why.
Yeah, Caddy. Yeah, I remember that.
I remember the Britannica encyclopedia of it. So there's still no internet at this stage, kind of thing. I hadn't come across the internet. And then at school, we then had a... They had me BBC Micros with 5.5-inch floppies. And then, like, I got into, like, a gang of people copying them and playing games at lunchtime with, like, the classic Chucky Egg. That's a good game.
I used to have Chucky Egg on the Spectrum.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert for my computer history.
I can remember having a Spectrum, my mate having it when he ran around house. You had to, whoever woke up first, you stay around it, you had to go off and put the tape on first so that it... ready to play kind of thing. So and then at college, when I went to do my electronics college, they all had Windows 3.1 with networking on it, and that's like the first time I got to see the kind of the internet kind of thing, because Windows 3.1 was the Windows with networking, wasn't it? I think, if I remember correctly,
I think it was 3.11, wasn't it?
Yeah, 3.11. Well, yeah,
you could kind of add it onto Windows 3.1, I think.
Yeah,
I don't think I got into networking stuff until like Windows 95.
Yeah, then they had Windows 95 there as well. And that's when I first got my first PC at home, which was a Pentium 1 with 150 MMX, But I have no idea what memory that had in it. I can't imagine it had much more than 32 mega RAM in it, I'm guessing, wouldn't you think?
I would have thought. What year was that?
So that would have been 97, 98, I think.
Around that time I think I had 16. I think 16 was the minimum to run Windows 95, 16 meg.
Yeah. So we had 32.
And then people started having 32, 64 around that sort of time.
Yes, yeah, so that's when I started getting into computers, really wanted and getting a job in IT kind of thing and starting. Yeah, cause I remember getting a hard drive, external hard drive, to basically... Actually, I remember getting Windows 95 Plus first so that you could compress it, which is an add-on. I remember my friend worked for a big IT company, a big insurance company. He gave me a copy of 95 Plus, which means you basically could... You got that pinball game and you can compress your hard drive, so you got more space.
Was that Stacker? There was a thing called Stacker. Because hard drive space was at a real premium in those days, and like you might get a 20 meg drive, which when you think about it is like 15 floppy disks. So there was this software which basically compress it on the fly. I think it put it like to the bare metal, it looked like a file.
Yeah.
But then you ran this thing in memory which decompressed it and compressed it on the fly.
All I had was this Windows 95 Plus thing, which is an add-on kind of thing. Yeah, so that's like my main PC. And that's like from there, just as you get on more and more and more kind of thing. So NT4 was my first kind of then enterprise product I've seen. Because I didn't even knew about, until I got my first job in IT, that you could actually do things like file sharing and stuff. And seeing NT4. And then Windows 2000 was when I first... was released the year I really got into IT kind of thing. And then, yeah, so that's kind of my history.
Windows 2000 was basically NT5, though, wasn't it? I think they almost called it NT5.
Yes. So it was the kernel where they had the NT kernel or whatever, how it had its own little kernel space or whatever for each application. Whereas then 95 and stuff, 98 was like DOS, wasn't it, based? Whereas NT4, and there was a kernel-based thing, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah, I used to run NT4 because I didn't play that many games, but you know, for whatever reason I couldn't either get hold of or couldn't afford them or whatever, and so I put NT4 on because I was using things like 3D Studio, just in my spare time, and 3D software, and I think that performed better, and NT was a lot more stable than 95, 98 because they were DOS based and. So, yeah, I was using NT4 for quite a while. And then when I went to Windows 2000, it's like, hey, I can run all my games again. So didn't need to have like dual boot. Because I had problems dual booting. Windows 95 had problems because in those days, you had to muck around with IRQs and things
like
that. You had to go into the BIOS. If your add-on cards, they didn't always sort themselves out properly. So you had to go into the BIOS to change the IRQs and for that reason I couldn't run Windows 95.
Yeah, because I remember getting another hard drive for my PC, so it was like a family computer, so it's Pentium 1 1.5. I remember getting a hard drive, an extra hard drive to store stuff on, and it was a thing called like Computer Warehouse, where like you used to get cheap stuff or whatever. I remember getting a 56k internal modem from the... And I basically, when I put the hard drive in, I didn't know nothing about what you should have had in the hard drive. And it came with a CD. Oh, sorry, a floppy disk to do something. And I put the floppy disk in and it completely trashed the whole... I don't know what it did. Like, I was guessing it must have partitioned it at that point or something, or partitioned it. I had no idea what partitioning was. And then I just basically completely knackered the whole machine kind of thing. Had to start again from scratch.
And this is probably in the days where there's no way of getting decent backups. There's no such thing as an external hard drive. Or if there was, it was like... It wasn't a little handheld. Yeah. Yeah, I used to run... When I was doing all that 3D stuff, none of it was backed up a lot of the time. And I had a really dodgy hard drive, which was making weird noises, which...
Someone getting a CD or something from the magazine at college or like that, we're doing that 3D stuff. I can't remember what that, it wasn't Blender, that I'm guessing it is along, I don't know what they were What it used to be
a thing called Imagine, which is, funnily enough, my mate who had an Amiga used to run that. And then that's what kind of got me into thinking about doing 3D. And then I got 3D Studio, which is like the standard package on PC, basically.
Yeah. It was Imagine. That is it. That's what it was. I remember that.
Well, 3D Studio is a lot easier to use, I remember.
It had like four windows. I remember that. It had like four windows.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So who wants to go next?
I can. So I started on the Amstrad, just like you did, but I had the CPC 464, which was slightly inferior to the one that you had, with only half the memory of what you had. But you know that was released 32 years ago, amazingly.
And that was basically a rebadged Spectrum, though, wasn't it? Because Alan Sugar bought Sinclair, or bought him out because it was just losing so much money. His company was Alan Sinclair's. Is it Alan Sinclair's?
I think it was, yeah.
Clive Sinclair. His money was losing so much money that Alan Sugar just bought him out and basically rebadged the Spectrum, that the kind of thing that they'd been developing, into the...
It's very simple, yeah.
C464, yeah.
Yeah. That's what Amstrad stood for. AMS of Amstrad was...
AMS Trading.
Alan Michael Sugar. And then the trad was trading, yeah. So that's what Amstrad stood for, and I know it ran up until 1990. They were still selling them. That they came out in 1984 and ran until 1990. Yeah. And now you had the 3-inch, called AmSoft discs. Well, the 464 had the cassette tape. It ran at 4 megahertz, I think, was the processing speed of it. And of course the 464 was 64 kilobytes of memory, so you would have had 128 kilobytes, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Didn't I never notice that? I never thought of why it was that.
I didn't know what the difference was. I had a colour screen, yeah, because you could get it as a green screen, couldn't you?
Because it had it had its own monitor. You had to get like a converter to connect to a normal TV. I remember it now. It had like three cables from it. I don't know what the three cables were. Between the two kind of thing.
I had a proper monitor for it.
Yeah, that's what I had.
But you could have a green screen or you could have a colour screen. So I had it in colour. Now, wasn't it? So it was 8-bit. So how many colours did that make it? Is it something like a
256?
No, it didn't have that many. It was.
If it's an 8-bit processor, that's different from 8-bit colour.
Yeah. Because an 8-bit processor, but the colour was something that, because I think it was only like 8 colours or something. That's all you had.
No, 3-bit. That's 3-bit colour.
Was it? Yeah. So.
Similar to the Spectrum, I think, or if not exactly the same.
But it was great. I mean, I learnt loads on that. But there was one difference, because now you're saying before you couldn't save games and things like that. Well, there was a couple of games that I had that you could save. Because it was on cassette, you could...
So
I'd just have a regular cassette. So now you could buy proper computer cassettes, couldn't you? I don't know what the difference from a normal cassette to a computer cassette was myself, but you could just put a normal cassette in, you know, press save game, you know, make sure the tab was on for the read write thing on the cassette, and you could record. It would record a series of bits and bobs, you know, a bit of data onto that cassette, and then. You know, and then when you reloaded it next time, you could bring it back again. But they were basically... I never knew the difference between the 64 and the 64K and the 128K, because it was all the same software that you used for both of them, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, it was the same program you could buy and it worked on both computers. So I don't know whether one just ran a bit quicker, or maybe there's some software that needed that extra memory, you know, and wouldn't work on the other one.
There was a strange period. I remember, I think it was when I was at secondary school. So, you know, back in the midst of time, late 80s, early 90s. We had, I'll get onto another spoiler here. I had an Atari ST in the sort of around 1990, I think, or maybe a bit earlier. And there were games like Batman. You remember the original Tim Burton Batman game spin-off?
Okay.
A lot of my mates had a Spectrum at that time, and you had to load in each level. So you'd do a level, defeat the boss or whatever, and then you'd have to load in the level from tape.
yeah.
The next level. Whereas we had an ST with a floppy drive. It's like, seemed like the Stone Age to you know, the sort of 16-bit computer. But both these things coexisted at the same time, which is, it's worth mentioning, I think.
So did you have all those AmSoft games? Because the Amstrad came with a lot of games, didn't it? Like things like Oh Mummy, did you have things like that?
No.
I remember having Paperboy.
I remember seeing, there was a kiddies game show where they played Paperboy. It was one of the rounds.
Oh yeah,
it was like a quiz show.
So. Oh, remember, one on recently.
Was it Cauldron or something? No, like was it? Where they like had it like in a 3D in the backdrop, like they had it.
Nightmare,
that's it.
Yeah, yeah. That was an excellent game.
Yeah, so I mean, I learned loads and loads of stuff on that, and I must have had that for years, because technology didn't really progress very quickly back then, did it?
Yeah.
If you had that computer 1 year, you know, 3 years later, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, people would buy the same computer basically,
yeah.
And you know, it wouldn't be any different. You know, it wasn't as if they added any colours, but. Eventually, and I can't remember what year this was, it must have been beginning of the 90s, I suppose, but the next one I got was a Commodore Amiga 500, or 500 plus it might have been. Now, that was a little bit more advanced, so that had, that one had actual proper floppy disk, the 3.5 floppy disk. And it used, so it would have been the 720K floppy disks, I think it used. The processor was a bit quicker, it was about 7 megahertz, I think. I'm just looking at some of the specs of it. Here, I had 1 megabyte of memory, but it was expandable up to 10 megabytes, but I never did that. And the graphics were actually... 640 by 256, so getting a little bit more resolution in that. Don't know how many colours they had in a Commodore, but it must have been 256 colours, surely.
Yeah, I think it was at least that.
Yeah, it must have been, yeah. Now, I know there was different versions of the Amiga as well, wasn't there? Did you mention before there was an Amiga 1000, was there?
I think it was 1200.
Or 1200, yeah, that rings a bell, yeah.
A friend of mine was using that up until 97, 98 sort of time.
Yeah.
Like I said, yeah, he had Imagine on there, so he was seeing all this stuff.
Now, that's actually it's this computer. You know, we've all got bits where we sort of learn things, and there's this computer where I learned about file structures. You know, and having a root directory and having different fault directories and directories within directories. And I remember sort of reading that and learning about that and thinking, oh, God, this is the best thing I've ever heard. You know, that you could put fault directories inside of directories inside of directories. And another thing as well with, of course, it was on a floppy disk, so saving games was much easier on a Commodore, because, you know, you could just have floppy disk, you know, to save on. So those were the days as well. We used to have those big, remember those big plastic cases, which had a key on the front?
Oh, yeah.
You know, which no one ever took the key out, because why would you? And then...
And a turbo button.
Yeah. And then they're all sort of all stacked up in a row in there. And then you have to write on the label what you had.
And leaf through them, like.
Yeah. And they have to flick through them, you know, like you're flicking through records at a record shop.
Yeah.
Flick, flick, flick. Got it. And, yeah, so, and also remember on that, I remember playing, you know, you said, what was that game you said before? Elite. I remember having Elite 2 on that one. And I also started my car simulation programs off on that one with the original MicroProse Grand Prix game. The Grand Prix.
Also, do you ever play Stunt Car Racer?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And you went up the loop-the-loop and everything. Yeah, it had a big, massive steering wheel on the...
Yeah. Actually, a really good game on that era of computer was Carrier Command. Did you ever play that?
No, but I know which one you mean. I had a different one that was an aircraft one. I can't remember what it was. Oh.
You had control of this like aircraft carrier from the future, and it had planes and little amphibious vehicles, and you could fly the planes around, and you could tell them where to go on a map and things, and then you could take control of them and launch missiles and things, and go back to the carrier, and tell it to land. And it's all 3D, like 3D graphics.
Yeah.
It's really good for the time.
The other one I had was called Dogfight.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, because I think at this point these computers could kind of do kind of, well, it was 3D, wasn't it, really? It was 3D vectors and all that kind of stuff, but
yeah.
Obviously it was very,
very... Very basic still, but much better than what came before.
Yeah, I mean, you can see how it's come along. You see, at the time, that was it, wasn't it? At the time, that was amazing graphics.
Mm.
You know, being able to take control of these things.
I spent hours on flight simulators. We had one on EST.
Yeah.
And I had this one where it was called Falcon, where you could fly an F-16. Fly an F-16.
I remember my friend had a joystick as well, which is like a proper joystick to kind of like...
Yeah, that's when
kind of flying.
Proper analog joysticks were started to be used, weren't they? You know, that... In fact, you remember on the Amstrad, they had the joystick on that, but it was only click and click.
Yeah, I remember that.
You know,
like a 9-pin connector, isn't it, to go in the side of it?
So to go left, you just clicked it left. It was on or off, basically. You know, rudimentary, of course. It was just on or off, left or right.
I remember having a game called Winter Games, and you had to go
Oh, yeah, to run by just wiggling a joystick from side to side.
Yeah. When First Class was that program on BBC One where they used to have the...
Oh, yeah.
With Debbie Green, pretended by Debbie Greenwood.
Have you seen recently the 8-bit? It's been on Dave or something like that on the TV. It's got Dara O'Brien and then different guests coming on every week, and the show was called Go 8-Bit, and they were basically playing old games against each other.
Was it called Go 8-Bit or something?
Go 8-Bit, yeah. So some of them was quite, there's probably about 6 episodes, and there was different celebrities, you know, well, when I say celebrities, B actors or B people or people presenters or
Z list,
you know, you'll probably recognize them or know them from certain things, but they basically went on the two teams and they'd play old Amstrad games or you know, sometimes they were a little bit newer, you know, and they'd basically do 2-player games against each other and see who wins the show.
I have to look that up.
Yeah, it's worth watching a few of them just to see some of the old games, and then you might think, oh, God, you know, we might find that. You know, because all these things we're talking about, I don't know how good they are, but I'm sure you can get some emulators, you know, so that you can run them on today's computers.
Yeah, done that.
There's something called MAME, which is really good for the old arcade machines. It basically emulates the old arcade machines perfectly.
Oh, wow.
And you can play all these old games that you know. I don't know about anyone else, but I could never afford to put any money in them, so I just used to watch other people play.
Yeah.
And very occasionally be able to play it, and then I'll be dead in 2 seconds.
Yeah. Oh, I love any arcades. I love things like Outrun.
Go Run. Outrun, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, Outrun and... it was usually racing ones, but occasionally you'd play kind of Street Fighter 2 or something. It did, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was great. Now, one of them had, the seat moved.
Yeah.
You know, so as you accelerated, the seat went backwards, and the seat, when you braked, it went forward. You know, so that was quite, quite interesting. But after I went from the Amiga, I've been trying to rack my brains what I did after that, but it's just that progression, isn't it? Because I'm pretty sure I got a 386 after that. And I don't think it was an IBM one. I think it was one of these IBM compatibles. Mm. And then, but I do remember getting my first Pentium. Because I did have a 486 SX, was it? I did have a 486 for a while. And I think that ran Windows 3.11.
It almost gets to the stage where you're just swapping out parts, though, isn't it? And eventually you've got a new computer. You had a 486 and then you had a Pentium, but if you had the same hard drive or the same power supply or whatever.
Yeah, you know, basically, yeah, that's it. I mean, I haven't bought a new computer, you know, in 20 years, basically. it's just been changing this bit, changing that bit. You know.
Tiggers broom, rigger, no, whatever his name is, triggers.
Yeah, it's been, that's all it's been. It's you know, change the case every now, you know, every so often. You know, but that
you
was
never change the case at the same time as all the other components.
I usually transfer the stuff into another case because it's got, I don't know, it hasn't felt a bit, or it's got more. Yeah. Ports on the front or something, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so now I've gone from that to, you know, I don't even know how I've got there, you know. And then this one here, I mean, I've got a couple now, but this one here is an i5 16 gig and a decent graphics card. It's just been a progression, hasn't it? But I can't remember. I know I had a 386 and a 486, but actually I do remember getting the P75, which is the first Pentium that came out, and that was a whole new computer. And I can't remember how much memory that had on it. I was actually working in a computer store at the time. Building them and for customers and stuff, so I was on a workbench just bolting them together, and those were the days as well. Remember the IDE cables? Eventually they ended up having a keyway on them, so you couldn't put them in backwards.
Yeah.
But at that point in time you could put them in backwards, you know, there was no kind of way to say. Yeah, yeah, that was the thing, you know. As soon as they built it and switched it on, it didn't work. And they had to go through everything and figure out what it was. I used to do the ribbon cable had a red line on one of the pins, which I'd call pin one. So then I'd just do the red line to pin one, you know, things like that. And also at the time, with these different processors, you had to set a load of jumpers on the motherboard. For that specific processor, you know, for whatever speed it ran at. And if you didn't set those jumpers right, it didn't work either. So that was always a pain. So you had to make sure you get that right.
There was also with hard drives, there was master and slave. And you had to put the jumper in for whether it was master or slave. Because you have two drives on the same bus, can you? And then one had to be master, one had to be slave. Didn't make any difference, you know, when you actually booted it up, but... like which one came up first, sort of thing. Which one was HD? Yeah, well, which one was HDB?
Yeah, but then they have Cable Select as well. That was another one that they had, wasn't it?
I think that was the automatic one, so it just sorts itself out.
Yeah.
But yeah, then you need two drives. You put them both on CS, yeah.
You need two drives that can actually do that.
Yeah, because my Pentium 1 was 50 was from a computer shop in Norwich called Mass Computers. Because that was a time you could buy a magazine and you had to select where you wanted to get it. It was like from Time PC or... It was before the world, that was like 96. So it was, I think, before PC World was about, kind of thing. So you had to either order it online or go to somewhere else to kind of...
My dad used to get Computer Shopper, I remember that.
Yeah.
It's mostly adverts. But
used to get magazines all the time. There's a question, though. I'll tell you what mine was, but what was your first ISP? And my first ISP was CompuServe.
My uncle was on CompuServe.
Yeah. So what was your first ISP? Do you remember?
Mine was...
I think it must have been BT. It must have been, because you used to just get these things where you could phone a number and pay. They just take the charge as the cost of the call, I think, or something. I think that's how it worked. So you didn't actually have to subscribe to anything. You could just phone a number.
Oh, yeah, it was a penny a minute, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that. it was quite expensive. So it was about the amount of time you were online, not how much you actually did when you were online.
Okay.
Or someone picking up the phone while you're on the line, it killed you.
So did you start on... I think I started on a 36K modem. And then ended up with a 56K modem. But I know you could get 28Ks as well, couldn't you? Mm. I think it was a US Robotics. If that rings a bell.
Yeah.
US Robotics, 56K. 56K modem.
Yeah.
And then the first broadband, if you want to call it that, was NTL. I don't know if you had NTL.
Yeah, we had NTL. All right, that was our first. Yeah, we got the cheapest broadband package, which was a cable modem, which was 128K.
Yeah.
Which is still good because it was always on and you weren't kind of thinking, oh, how long are we going to be online for?
Yeah, I had, looking at the Mass Computers are still there today, apparently. They've even got an advert on there. I'll put a link in the show notes. They've even got like an advert to their their colour things. Yeah, I was Force 9 is who I chose. Now, like, that was like an hour. You had to pay like a monthly fee, but you still had to dial a number. It was like an 0845 or like a local calls number. It was like FreeServe came along, and then everybody was everyone went to the free internet, didn't they? Kind of thing. But I'm still with PlusNet today. So Force 9 was PlusNet.
I'm with PlusNet now.
So PlusNet, I've been with them since like all the time. And like, I remember when you first got ADSL and you had to get like 1,000 people in your town to kind of like sign up before they would kind of they would enable your exchange kind of thing. So
yeah, yeah.
What was the one they used to have, which was two lines? Wasn't there one years ago where you had to have two phone lines?
It was, yeah, you used to get ISDN and then you get ISDN Highway. So yeah. ISDN would be the two channels, but you get ISDN Highway, which is two channels plus an analog, but you could use an analog and one of the ISDN channels at once kind of thing. You couldn't use all three at once kind of thing, if I remember correctly.
It all brings back memory.
Anyway, so what about you then, Jerry?
We started off with a ZX81, which was, you know, the first, second, I think, one from Sinclair. But I think my dad got that, and just because he was interested in it. And quickly realised he couldn't do much with it. So then it was ZX Spectrum after that, which we had for years. I think we're talking about, replacing parts. My dad basically took the motherboard out of the original Spectrum and put it in a new case. And I think he's still got that. And I think we've played it, you know, fairly, well, I'll say fairly recently, in, maybe in the last decade or so. So yeah, it still keeps going.
I love the buttons on that.
Yeah, well, this one had a like proper keyboard buttons. The case that you put it into, just because you thought it's more practical. He was using it for work and stuff, and like he built his own database application, I think, in ZX Basic to help with his paperwork for work. But mostly we just play games on it. And so, yeah, we've got loads of games.
My mate had School Days and Jet Set Willy.
Yeah. The first game I think I played was Manic Miner. And Jet Set Willy's from the same guy.
Right.
The same sort of graphics, really. Same sort of sprites. Much bigger.
Yes. No saves, just three lives.
No. Although I think we had a cheat where you started off with 20 odd lives, but it didn't make any difference because if you fell, there was a thing where you could fall out of one room. There's basically a load of rooms, basically levels next to each other. You could walk from one to the other. But if you fell out of the bottom of one and then into the bottom of into the top of another one,
yeah,
if you fall far enough, you die. So you just end up continually falling. Dying, falling, dying, falling, and that's it. That's your lot. That was the downside of that.
What computer was that?
That was ZX Spectrum.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a whole sort of host of games that people like BBC Micro people played different games, like Chucky Egg, obviously, and Elite, which you just couldn't get on the Spectrum, but there were games like Manic Miner and that you can only get on the Spectrum.
If you go on to say Google Images or something and do Jet Set Willy, you can actually get a map of the entire place. And I wish I had that back then.
Yeah. I think we did. We had a magazine.
Oh, did you?
And it had all these levels kind of just mapped out. It didn't obviously have the detail of each level, but you could tell where each room was in relation to the other one.
Yeah.
I remember drawing that once as well, a game.
Yeah.
You start drawing on a bit of paper trying to work out where you go.
There's one called Attic Attack, which I think my uncle and my dad played, and they actually did a map of where all the things were, and they finished it. Did it systematically.
Yeah. But going back to the Spectrum, I think there's like a BBC did a programme, must be on YouTube, I find it, where like it shows you how Sinclair like failed with the kind of like
I think it's actually an iPlayer. It's called the Computer Program.
Yeah,
and they it's just one of those ones that they leave on there. But it's quite nostalgic. I remember watching it the first time. I think we even taped it. So you could refer back to it, sort of thing. Yeah, it's interesting to watch those because they're obviously a long time ago. Another good one, actually, on iPlayer is called it's Horizon from like the mid 70s. I might have mentioned it before, actually. It's called Now the Chips Are Down, and it's about what they're predicting what you could do with microchips, basically, and microcircuits and things like that. So, yeah, interesting stuff. So after that, basically, the next one we got was the Atari ST, and that was the. I think it had one megabyte of RAM, 1024. It was Atari ST 1024, so 1 mega RAM. No attachment, so you could plug it into a telly. So you had to have Atari's own monitor with it.
All right.
So I think most of my mates had the half meg version that you could plug into a telly. So. That's the only difference, though. And again, we just played loads of games on it. I think it might be mentioned. Atari ST is still used in music studios because they've got MIDI direct MIDI interface.
Keybase.
Yeah, which I think is still used up until quite recently, anyway. So we had a music package on there, which. I think I had a MIDI keyboard you could plug into it, which you could then, you know, and the notes would come out on the package and stuff. So, yeah, it's good. It's a good little machine, really. But, yeah, I mean, after that, it just went on to the PCs after that, really. My dad got a PC. Funnily enough, it was an Amstrad PC, 386, which...
Does it have a Mega Drive built into it or not?
A Mega Drive?
Yeah,
Sega Mega Drive.
There was a CPC with a 38, which had a... It was announced called an Amstrad Mega PC. It had a Sega Mega Drive plugged into it.
Wow. All right. That would have been excellent. No, it wasn't one of those. But they were quite incompatible, I think, those with... They weren't particularly compatible with normal PCs. Like, you couldn't... They had to have their own mouse, keyboard, I think. They may be software compatible, but not hardware compatible, kind of thing. So you can upgrade them and do all that stuff that you could do with other PCs. And I got when I went to university, my dad got some parts that he had and put together a 386 for me. And I think he probably had like a 486 DX by that time. And that was, Andy, you were saying earlier about Elite 2. Was that Frontier?
That's right, yes. Yeah, Frontier Elite, yeah.
So I had that for the PC, and I did quite a bit on that. I got quite far.
Yeah.
You know,
I managed to
upgrade my ships and stuff. It's still around, actually. It's, if you listen to Geek News Radio, you can hear Fab going on about it.
Yeah.
Is it Elite Dangerous?
I think
it's called Elite Dangerous, yeah, the latest incarnation of that. But wouldn't mind having a go on that. I wouldn't know when I would have the time to do it. I know my brother's quite into it.
Yeah, Elite Dangerous.
Yeah. It's by the same bloke, as far as I can tell, David Braben. He did also, as well as the Elite games, he did my other favourite ever computer game on the ST, which was called Virus, also called Zark, which was on the Archimedes, that was like a 3D thing where your little ship is like a hover, basically hovers, you can control the amount of thrust and you sort of tip it over to go forwards and so on, a bit like a helicopter, and it's got a little square of 3D land underneath you. And then you've got to go and chase these ships around, shoot at them. Yeah, it's really good Virus. I'll put that in the show notes, actually. Yeah, it's weird. I don't play a lot of games these days, but I played loads in the past.
I think that was mentioned on the Ubuntu podcast, the Elite Dangerous. I think it was mentioned a couple of months ago.
Oh, right.
Because I heard it and I thought, And of course, he mentioned it runs on Linux as well. Obviously,
oh, right.
but you can get it for the Xbox and all that lot.
Okay.
I would go through my list of games consoles, but it's quite limited to none.
Yeah.
So,
I think I got a PlayStation in the original PlayStation secondhand in the late 90s, but I think. Hadn't had one before that, hadn't had a games console because we just had computers.
Yeah, I mean, we
can... Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. So we got a Wii and an Xbox, but they're not really mine, but I do use them. But yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, getting looking at that Elite thing, and one of the people who were developers was a company called Firebird, and Firebird was one of the people who, one of the games I got the games on the CPC. Apparently, it was owned by Telecomsoft. He were a division of BT. Was it?
Right.
How odd is that kind of thing? So that's a bit random kind of thing. So, but going back also on the computer file thing we had the week, there's one. Did you watch one about the one about there's a guy who's writing a Sega game in assembly? So he's found this. Okay, there's only a couple of these left in the world apparently. Like they're like. Sega Mega Drive with like a bit on the bottom, and They were used to code the original Sega Mega Drive games, and you can basically code them, kind of thing. So you can connect this Mega Drive to a PC, and then you do the assembly code, actually writing the assembly code on the computer, then upload it to the then you can debug it on the Mega Drive, kind of thing. It's worth a watch, kind of thing.
There's also, isn't there, like a Super Nintendo tiny, it's in the controller or something.
Yeah, they've got kind of new, yeah.
Where the whole SNES thing's in the controller and you just plug it into the TV.
But the guy's actually going to release this game when he's writ it on an actual cartridge, kind of thing. But so I didn't really...
You need a Mega Drive to actually play it.
And some of the people are saying actually that you can get a Mega Drive now, and then you can get like this adapter, so like you can put like an SD card in them, kind of thing, so that you can actually play the old. So if you had the ROM, you can download them off the web and then put them into a cartridge and then put them in your machine, kind of thing. So you can actually play them on your original PC, kind of thing, on the original Mega Drive. Sorry. So okay.
That'd be interesting.
Okay, anything else to...
I don't think so.
Okay, so next time I want to talk about OpenStack, I'm doing a project at work about it. Well, I've been looking into it, so I'm going to have a go on that. The other thing is that I wanted just to bring up, it's a bit of a somber thing, really, that one of the people, I've never had this happen before, but one of the people I've met online has actually passed away of cancer. I never met the guy, but he actually emailed into the show a couple of times. So it's a bit somber, really, kind of thing, thinking about it, kind of thing.
So who was it?
It was a, I don't know, looking up actually, I think it was like called, this is really bad now, I don't know, cut this out. I think it was like called Underlord or something, or Drake Lord or something. He emailed in a couple of times because he's like telling us he was talking about open source virtualization technology, kind of thing. So,
Lord Drakenblood.
Yes.
No, I think I saw someone on Twitter mention they passed away, and I went onto his Twitter feed.
Matthew Williams is real, isn't it?
Right.
And then, you know, he emailed it a couple of times in the show. So, but this is a bit odd. He never, Lord, yeah. So,
Yeah, well, may you rest in peace.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, he mentioned that Proxmox VE.
Yes.
Which is a KVM virtualization system.
Okay, well, we'll leave it on that note, and we'll probably won't be next. We'll be the last one of the year, I reckon. So we're probably back in 2016, however.
Surely we should leave them laughing, though, shouldn't we?
Yes.
We should leave them laughing.
A joke. What was that joke I sent the other day? I can't remember what it was now.
Oh, the street.
Oh, that was it. Can you remember it? I can't remember what it was. I like the one about the UDP packet went into a bar and no one acknowledged him.
Quick geek jokes.
I was trying to think that other one, what that message was the other day I sent about the going up the memory lane or whatever it was. I've just given around a punchline now, haven't I? So.
I think that was it. It was something like hang on. Went to a street and the houses were numbered 2, 4, 8, 16, 32.
Right. I walked down the street where the houses were numbered 64K, 120K, 256K, 521K, and a megabyte. That was a trip down memory lane.
Yeah. Okay, an SQL statement walks into a bar and sees two tables. It approaches and asks, "May I join you?"
Very good. We won't be going for a curry either, though, like they do on the Ubuntu podcast. We can't get
too far away.
Yeah.
Mind you, I'm going to be in Milton Keynes next week.
Oh, I was in Milton Keynes this week. I was actually in Milton Keynes this week, actually, for a meeting.
Oh, we just missed each other.
I had an A7 actually. My company car broke. The clutch went in it over only 10,000 miles, and they lent me an A7 with like a free. Yeah, it was nice, but it was really big. I was really scared that I'd scratch or something kind of thing. So. Okay, well, we'll see everyone in 2017, not like 2016. I said a minute ago. So
please not to 2016 again.
No. Well, we have got anyway. Well, I won't mention that. But okay, we'll speak to you all soon.
See you next year.
Bye.